So the timid student approaches the master with great reverence. As the new kid in town, he's tired of being bullied, and so young Daniel goes to the legendary Mr. Miyagi, and he asks for help, help to teach him the ancient art of karate. Mr. Miyagi finally agrees, but he tells Daniel, he says, here's the deal. You have to do whatever I tell you to do if you want me to train you. Daniel's kind of desperate with the whole thing, so he says yes, and Mr. Miyagi looks, and there's a bucket of water, and he says, Daniel, the first thing I want you to do is I want you to wash and wax my cars. And Daniel's kind of like, well, I don't know what this has to do with karate, but Mr. Miyagi just insists on it. And he says, here's what I want you to do. Put the wax on with your right hand, wax on, wax off with your left hand, wax on, wax off. So Daniel goes about and he washes and waxes all the cars, and he's exhausted at the end of the night. But he comes back the next day because he's ready to get some training in karate. Same kind of deal. Mr. Miyagi gives him some chores to do. He says, here's what I want you to do now, Daniel. I want you to paint the fence up and down. You paint the fence up and down. Next day, same thing. This time you paint the house back and forth, paint the house. And next day, same thing, sand the floor. And so this goes on for days. In fact, Mr. Miyagi actually leaves and goes fishing and leaves Daniel to do all these chores. Well, one day Daniel's had enough, and when Mr. Miyagi comes back from fishing, he screams at him and he says, am I just a slave to you or am I your karate student? And Mr. Miyagi gets kind of serious and he sets the fishing pole down, and he looks Daniel in the eyes and he says, Daniel, show me wax on. And he shows him wax on. Show me wax off. And then he says, show me paint the fence, paint the house, back and forth. And then he says, Daniel, look me in the eyes. And Mr. Miyagi throws the first punch. And just with instinct, Daniel wipes it away with wax on. And then he throws another one. It's wax off. And then he throws a kick at him. And he paints the fence. And it's this epic karate scene as he's throwing all these punches and kicks. And Daniel just instinctively has all the moves that he needs to knock away whatever Mr. Miyagi is throwing at him. And I remember in 1984, as a sophomore in high school, watching that movie and thinking to myself, this is so cool. After all, he didn't know what he was even doing, but Mr. Miyagi is the great master, because even when Daniel didn't understand what he was doing, it was all training for the real thing. And I thought, what an amazing lesson. Well, I don't know if in your Christian life you ever feel like Daniel. Like sometimes you're just going through the motions without even knowing what it's all about, without even knowing how it all fits together. And in fact, some people might say that the book of 1 Corinthians might feel a little bit like that. Because for 10 chapters we've been going through 1 Corinthians, and Paul keeps saying, Glenn, your life is not about you. Your life is about Christ. Your life is about putting others before yourself. Wax on, wax off. So for 10 chapters, Paul has been saying things like, here's how you put others first for the sake of unity. You lower yourself. Here's how you handle disagreements and lawsuits. You do it with humility. Here's how you handle your sexuality. You do it with purity. Here's how you handle if you're married or if you're single. You do it with contentment. Wax on, wax off, Paul is saying. Here's how you avoid judging others. Here's how you handle strange controversies like meat sacrificed to idols. You do whatever is going to put the other person above yourself. Here's what it means to be called into ministry, which is all about laying down your lives and your rights to serve other people. And if we're not careful, we can start to think, wait a second, Paul, am I a slave here? And has the master left and just gone fishing? But today, I think we come to one of those great passages where it all comes together and we can get a glimpse of what it's all about. You see, Paul has been giving us a lot of chores, if you will. But he's been saying now, he says, all of these things go into experiencing a full relationship with Christ. And today we get to slow down a little bit and we get to see how it all fits together in a bigger picture. And Paul does this. Paul points us to this bigger picture and how it all fits together by giving us instructions about what is called the Lord's Supper or communion. Communion is an essential practice that is sacred to Christians throughout the world for 2,000 years now. So here's what I'd love you to do. I'd love you to grab some message notes and open up your Bible to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And let me just read these verses that if you've been around church a little bit, some of these might sound really familiar to you. And I'm going to read 1 Corinthians 11, beginning in verse 17, where Paul says this. And remember, he's been answering questions back and forth with the Corinthians about how their life should look and how an essential church should look. And now about communion, he says this. In the following directives, I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good. And it's like, ouch, Paul says, even meeting together, it's worse than if you didn't even meet at all. It's doing more harm than good. So Paul says, in the first place, I hear that when you come together as a church, there are divisions among you. And to some extent, I believe it. He says, no doubt there have to be differences among you to show which of you have God's approval. So then, when you come together, it's not the Lord's supper you eat. For when you're eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers. As a result, one person remains hungry and the other gets drunk. Don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing? What shall I say to you in this? Shall I praise you? Certainly not in this matter. So Paul says you're coming together around divisions. And then he gives these familiar words. He says, but what I received from the Lord, in other words, what Jesus himself told me, what I received from the Lord, I also passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it. And he said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and you drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. So then, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of sinning against the body and the blood of the Lord. Everyone ought to examine themselves before they eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For those who eat and drink without discerning the body of Christ eat and drink judgment on themselves. That's why many among you are weak and sick, and a number of you have fallen asleep. And we'll go ahead and we'll stop there. You see, because outside of the four Gospels, that is really the clearest and the most complete description that we have in all of the New Testament of what we call the Lord's Supper. Sometimes you hear it called the Eucharist or Communion. And while Catholic and Protestant and Orthodox Christians all around the world may differ a little bit on some of the details of communion, what we see is that Christians throughout history have seen the value of this deep connection point with Christ that takes place through this meal. And in one form or another, people have practiced this sacred meal that goes all the way back to Jesus and his disciples. In fact, to me, it's just fascinating that when Jesus chose to give his followers, and we as his followers today, when he chose to give his followers something that they could remember him by, Jesus doesn't first give them a creed. Jesus doesn't first give them a doctrine. Jesus gives them a meal together, because a meal was an act of fellowship, and a meal was an act and the ultimate sign of love. And so let's look at this passage that we just read together. And it's interesting, in those verses, there's actually one Greek word that appears five times. It's the Greek word synergomai. It's kind of hard to pick out in English because it's translated differently in different places. But the word literally means to come together, to bring together. We might say to connect together. And this is so significant because the act of communion uniquely brings together or connects us together with some of the key truths of the Christian faith. And so we can say, oh, now I see what it's all about. And so today we're going to follow an outline that actually I first saw from Tim Keller, and I want to suggest how the Lord's Supper brings together or connects my life and your life as a follower of Christ to some of the key important truths of the Christian faith. So we're going to see four things. We're going to see that communion connects my life to the historic faith of the past, that communion connects my life to the life of Christ, communion connects my life to the community of believers, and communion connects my life to the future coming of Christ. So let's take a look at those. First of all, I want to suggest that communion connects my life to the historic faith of the past. So if you look at verse 23, when Paul starts to explain this, Paul says, "What I received from the Lord, I also passed on to you." And then he says this, "On the night that he was betrayed." So in other words, he's saying, what I'm about to tell you is not based on a made-up story. It's not a parable. It's not a metaphor. But what I'm about to tell you about is based on an actual night in history. The real night when the real Jesus was betrayed and handed over to be crucified. It's an event that's based in history. And what do we know about that night, on that night that Jesus was to be betrayed? Well, first of all, it was a night of the Passover. The Passover was the night when for generations, Jewish families had gathered together to remember the divine mercy of God in setting them free from slavery. So you remember the Passover story. You find that in Exodus 11 and 12, God's people, the Hebrew people, are slaves in Egypt. And they cry out to God, and God in his mercy hears their cry. And he says, yes, I will come and I'll deliver you from your slavery. So God sends them Moses. And Moses goes to the Pharaoh. In fact, he goes to the Pharaoh 9 times. And he says, the Lord says, let my people go. Nine times, Moses does an amazing miracle. 9 times, Pharaoh hardens his heart and says, no, I will not let God's people go and be free from slaves. They're going to live here under the oppression. And so finally, the 10th plague is the worst of them all. It's the death of the firstborn. And God says to Moses that there's going to be a night when his hand is going to pass over, and there's going to be a death of the firstborn unless there's blood that covers the doorframe of the house. And so God says to Moses, here's what I want you to do. Tell the people, all the people, to take a lamb or a goat and to sacrifice that lamb. And then to eat the meal and to celebrate that meal, but then to take the blood from that sacrifice and to put it over the door frame of the house. And on that night, my hand will pass over. And when I pass over and I see the blood of that lamb covering the doorframe of that house, I will pass over in my mercy. And that's exactly what happens in Exodus chapter 11. And then the very next day, we see that God prepares them to leave and to head out into the wilderness. And he parts the Red Sea. And eventually, he delivers them from slavery and he moves them towards the promised land. And so each spring since that time, the Jews would celebrate what God had done. And they would celebrate by eating a meal together. And at this meal, there would be bread that was made without yeast to remember that it was all done in haste. And they would drink wine, and there would be a supper of lamb. And going back to Exodus 12, they're taught that this is the way the meal should be eaten, and it should not be changed, and it always should be remembered. It should never be forgotten. And so on the night that Jesus was betrayed, on that historic night, it was a Passover night. And so Jesus gathered together with his disciples for a meal. And everything was going great on that Passover night until Jesus spoke up and he changed the traditional script. Right? Because there would always be the child would always say, tell us why tonight is different than all the other nights. And they would rehearse all of the things from the book of Exodus. And yet on that night, Jesus takes the bread and he doesn't say the same familiar script. He actually takes the bread and after breaking it, he gives it to the disciples and he says, this is my body broken from you. It's a pretty dramatic difference from what had been taught in the Passover before that. And then he says, this is my blood. And he takes the cup and he says, it's the blood of a new covenant that you can be in relationship with God through the sacrifice that I'm about to give to you. And on that night, the gospel writers don't tell us that there was a meal of lamb, but what they tell us was that Jesus Christ was present there with them. And from the very beginning, when Jesus first comes onto the scene, what do those who know him best identify him as? They say, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And it's the fulfillment of ancient prophecies that go back even to the book of Isaiah, where Isaiah says things like, by his stripes, by his wounds, we will be healed. By his sacrifice, we will find healing. So in other words, by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and the blood that covers over the doorframe of our hearts, we can be set free from slavery. We can be set free from the bondage of sin. We can find ultimate forgiveness. It's the blood of a new covenant, and it's based in history. You see, on that historic night, it was a night that was like no others. And yet it was a sacred way. Our life is connected to those events all those years later when we come to the table and we eat the bread and we drink the cup. We are connected to those events in history. And today, as we eat and we drink, as we join the church around the world today, and we join the church throughout history and across generations, connecting ourselves to this historic event of Christ's death and our delivery from the slavery of sin. And you know, one of the reasons that this is so significant is here we are at this point in history. Here we are in 2020, and it's the year that just won't quit, right? It's just one bad thing after another. And yet, as we gather together with the body and the blood of Christ, we're reminded that through the generations, people have endured far, far worse than this. And Christ has prevailed, and the church has stood strong. And we're reminded in that as we take communion today and we're connected not to just a story, not to a parable, but to historic events in the past. And so communion connects us in that way. But you know what else? Communion connects my life to Christ-like and life. And that's point number two. Communion connects my life to Christ's life. Tim Keller says it like this. He says, when Jesus says, this is my body, and then he puts bread in your hand, and then he says, this is my blood, and he puts a cup in your hand, one thing is very clear, which is that God is becoming very accessible, is what he says. In other words, this is God in the flesh. This is Jesus saying, I am sacrificing for you. I am allowing myself, the God of the universe, to be connected to you. That's why we call it communion. It is co-union with Christ himself. And we join ourselves to him in this sacred act. Now, when we take communion, when we take the Lord's Supper, it certainly connects us to Christ's death, right? Because it's the breaking of his body and the spilling of his blood. But even more than just connecting us to his death, it also connects us to his life and ultimately to his resurrection. And why is this significant? Because as followers of Christ, we want to live a Christ-like life. I want my life to look like that of Jesus. And yet I know that sometimes that is challenging and sometimes that's difficult, and I don't even know how I'm going to do it. Well, what we find is in communion, we're reminded not only of the model of Christ, but we're reminded of the power that comes through his resurrection. And I can almost picture Paul saying to the Corinthians, remember all these things I've told you. Remember wax on, wax off. Remember all these things that seem challenging for you to lay down your life. You know where you get the power for that? You get it in the sacred connection that you have with Christ when he says, this is my body and this is my blood poured out for you. And so communion connects my life to the life of Christ himself. And when I face challenges and when I don't know where to turn and when I feel discouraged and when I feel defeated, I can be reminded that I am connected through a co-union with Christ himself. Third thing we see in this passage is that communion connects my life to the community of believers. Communion connects my life to your life and to the life of the church, the local church and the church around the world. So now it's no surprise, based on all that we've been learning about the Corinthians in this study, in these first 10 chapters, there's no surprise that this young, kind of struggling group of Christians, that Paul is going to have some criticism for them about the way that they're taking communion. A lot of 1 Corinthians is Paul's correction of them, so it's no surprise that he's got some corrections for them. But what we see is that the correction that Paul gives is around the area of divisions. And he says that when you come together, you're doing it in a way that is excluding people and is causing division. He says it's doing more harm than good because it's pushing people away, not inviting them in. You see, for them to take the Lord's Supper was not for them to just take a tiny little taste of a cracker and a little sip of some juice or some wine, but it was a full meal. And instead of their meals that they celebrated together as a part of their church services, instead of those meals being inclusive and welcoming and creating fellowship and creating worship, what we saw is that they came together and they were dividing up. And some were eating too much, and some were drinking too much, and some were not sharing with others, especially the poor were being excluded, right? The wealthy would come and they would have their meal and they wouldn't share it with the poor. Some were even getting drunk. And Paul says, hey, you are doing more harm than good. That's why in verse 33, it says this, brothers and sisters, when you gather to eat, when you come together, you should all eat together. And that's one of the things that we see in a meal in the Bible, is it's designed to bring fellowship. It's designed to bring connection together. And we see this in the Lord's Supper, but we see it throughout Jesus's life. In fact, one of the things that we see time and time again in Jesus's life is his willingness to sit down and share a meal with people. In fact, a few years ago as a church, we did a study on all of the different meals of Jesus. And one of the most common criticisms of Jesus was that he would, you know, he was a glutton. He would eat too much. Or he was a drunkard, or he was a friend of sinners, because he was always inviting all these people to sit down and have a meal with him, and it drove the religious people crazy. And communion is that same kind of thing. It's a place where we're invited by Christ. And one of the things that we see when we see the meals of Jesus, and we see this portrayed in communion as well, is that it ought to remind us that at the Lord's Supper, at a meal with Jesus, that everyone is welcome. Everyone is welcome. You see, in the ancient Near East, a meal meant fellowship. A meal meant acceptance. And what do you see but Jesus going around and inviting people and saying, you can be welcome at my table. In fact, if you even think about that first communion where Jesus was with his disciples, he's there with Peter and James and John. But you know who else is at the table that night? Judas is at the table, right? And that decision had already been made that he was going to betray Jesus. But the idea is this, anyone who is willing to turn to Christ is welcome at his table. You see, with the body and the blood of Christ, everyone is welcome. A second thing that we see there is that everyone is welcome and no one is perfect. No one is perfect. One of the things that happens there at the Lord's table is we are all on equal ground, right? We're all the same at this point. And all of us are there needing Christ. In fact, it talks about in verse 27 about taking communion in a worthy manner. He says, don't eat it in an unworthy manner and to examine our lives. And that's really good for us to reflect on our lives and examine, especially our areas of fellowship that he's talking about, or areas of division. But the reality is that none of us is worthy. There's not one person among us that is worthy to sit at the table with Christ apart from his grace and apart from his forgiveness. You see, at the table, no one is perfect. And I think about, again, from Jesus' life, after his death, Peter had denied him three times. His closest friend denies, even knows him three times. And Jesus raises from the dead. And when he sees Peter, what does he do? The very first thing he does is he sits down with him at a meal. And he was reminding that nobody's perfect, but I am with you and I can fill your life. And so everybody is welcome and nobody's perfect. And you know what else takes place at this meal? There is no more us and them. That's what Paul is really saying to the Corinthians there. This is not a place for division. This is a place for unity. That's why throughout the New Testament, we're taught that there's no Jew or Greek. There's no slave or free. There's no rich or poor. There's no male or female. There is no us or them. And in this day of division that we live in, a communion can be this incredible equalizer as we come together and we are connected to one another in the community of believers, which is why when we think about communion, we may think, you know what? I've still got a problem with this person, or I'm holding a grudge against that person, or I've not forgiven that person. This would be the perfect moment to deal with that, to deal with that in your heart, to send them a message, to give them a call, to get up and say, you know what? At the foot of the cross, we can find forgiveness for ourselves, but we can find forgiveness for one another. So communion connects us to the community of believers. And then the last thing that this passage says, which is just awesome, is that communion also connects my life to Christ's future return. Verse 26 says this, For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. 1 Corinthians 11:26. So in other words, Jesus is coming again, right? He says, I am coming again. And when he comes, at last, when he makes all things new, what does the book of Revelation say is going to take place? It's going to be a meal. It's going to be a supper. Revelation 19 describes it as the wedding feast of the Lamb. And so that's going to be restored. And, you know, especially throughout this pandemic, there's been a lot of confusion. There's been a lot of division, but there's also been a lot of talk about the second coming of Christ. And that's a good thing. We're supposed to live ready for Christ's return. We're supposed to be ready for him to come back at any time. But one of the things that we see is there's also a lot of, you know, kind of wild speculation or even conspiracies about this virus or that vaccine or this chip or all these kind of things. And what do all those things do? They tend to push people away. They tend to divide, which is exactly the opposite of what Paul is saying here. Paul is saying that what you do to proclaim the Lord's death until he comes is you remember his sacrifice. You remember his love and his service, that he laid down his life. In fact, I think the clearest thing in the New Testament when it talks about what takes place before Christ's return is what Jesus himself says in Matthew 24, when he says, "And the gospel of the kingdom will be preached to the whole world as a testimony to all nations." That word is ethne, all people groups, all different people of the world. He says, "And then the end will come." So if you want to be busy about preparing your life for the second coming of Christ, be about proclaiming his gospel to all people, which we do when we proclaim the Lord's death until he comes through communion. Well, before we have the worship team lead us in a time of communion, I hope you're able to take that. I wanted to share kind of one story with you, and it's from a favorite book of mine. It's an old book by Philip Yancey called What's So Amazing About Grace. And I want you to hear this story. It's kind of long, but I want you to hear it as an invitation to the Lord's table today. And it goes like this. Says Jenny was a teenager who grew up in a cherry orchard just above Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents were a bit old-fashioned. They tended to overreact to her nose ring and the music she listened to and the length of her skirts. They grounded her a few times and she just seethed inside. "I hate you," she screamed when her father walked into her room after an especially heated argument. And that night, she acted on a plan that she had mentally rehearsed scores of times. She decided that she would run away to Detroit. On her second day there in Detroit, Jenny met a man who drove the biggest car she'd ever seen. He offered her a ride, bought her lunch, and arranged for a place for her to stay. He gave her some pills that made her feel better than she'd ever felt before. She had been correct all along, she decided. Her parents were keeping her from all the fun. The good life continued for a month and then 2 months, and then finally after that, into a year. The man with the big car, Jenny called him the boss, taught her a few things that men like. Since she was underage, men paid a premium for her. She lived in a penthouse and ordered room service whenever she wanted. Occasionally, she thought about her family and friends back in Traverse City, but their lives now seemed so boring to her, she could hardly believe that she had ever even lived there. After a year, the first ashen signs of illness appeared, and it amazed Jenny how fast the boss turned mean. Before she knew it, she was out on the street without a penny to her name. She still turned a couple of tricks at night, but that didn't pay much, and all the money was spent to support her drug habit. When winter arrived, she found herself sleeping on metal grates outside the big department stores. Sleeping was really the wrong word for a teenage girl at night in downtown Detroit. You could never relax your guard. Dark bands circled her eyes, and her cough got worse and worse. So one night, as Jenny lay awake, listening for footsteps, all of a sudden, everything about her life looked different. She no longer felt like a woman of the world. She felt like a little girl, lost in a cold and a frightening city. She began to whimper. Her pockets were empty, and she was hungry. She needed a fix. She pulled her legs tight underneath her, and she shriveled under the newspapers that she had piled atop her threadbare coat. Something jolted her memory, and a single image filled her mind. It was an image of springtime in Traverse City, with a million cherry trees blooming all at once. "God, why did I leave?" she said to herself. And pain stabbed at her heart, and she knew in a flash that more than anything else in the world, she wanted to go home. Jenny made 3 straight phone calls, each making the connection with the answering machine. She hung up without leaving a message the first two times. But the third time, she steeled herself and she said, "Dad, Mom, it's me. I was wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way and I'll get there about midnight tomorrow. If you're not there, well, I'll just stay on the bus until it reaches Canada." Well, it took 7 hours for the bus to get from Traverse City from Detroit. And during all that time, Jenny realized the flaws in her plan. What if her parents were out of town and missed the message? Even if they were home, they probably had written her off as dead long ago. Jenny's thoughts bounced back and forth between those worries and the speech that she had prepared for her father. "Dad, I'm sorry. I know it was wrong. It's not your fault. It's all mine. Dad, can you forgive me?" She said the words over and over, her throat tightening even as she rehearsed them. She had not apologized to anyone in years. When the bus finally rolled into the bus terminal, the driver announced in a crackly voice over the microphone, Traverse City, Michigan. 15 minutes, folks. That's all the time we have here. 15 minutes to decide her life. Jenny checked herself in a compact mirror, smoothed her hair, and licked the lipstick off her teeth, hoping her parents wouldn't criticize the way she looked. That is, if they were even there. Jenny walked into the terminal, not knowing what to expect, but not one of the thousand scenes that she had played out in her mind prepared her for what she saw. There in the bus terminal in Traverse City, Michigan, stood a group of 40 family members, brothers and sisters and great aunts and uncles and cousins and a grandmother to boot. They were all there wearing ridiculous looking party hats and blowing noisemakers, and taped across the entire wall of the terminal was a computer generated banner that read, "Welcome home." Out of the crowd of well-wishers stepped her dad, who ran to her and embraced her. Jenny looked at him through her tears and began the memorized speech. "Dad, I'm sorry, I know." Jenny's dad interrupted her and whispered to her, "Hush, child. Hush, we've got no time for that. No time for apologies. You're going to be late for the party. A banquet's waiting for you at home. There were no solemn lectures. There were no words of reproach. There was no unkindness hidden behind the hugs. There was simply love. Unexpected, undeserved grace and love. And today, Jesus invites each and every one of us, come home. Connect yourself to my life. Find the forgiveness and the grace and the leading and the power for your life in me. Let it all make sense and come join me at the table.